Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Hinwood. Norm erosion. Just one guest today, Paul Heidemann, talking about his new book on the Republican Party. On a day that our president is calling for Democratic members of Congress to be hanged for sedition, it's a good time to ask how this party became what it is today. The Republican Party was once a staid thing, the embodiment of the American business sensibility. There were exceptions, of course, notably maniacs like Joe McCarthy, but McCarthy eventually fell and the likes of Dwight Eisenhower prevailed. The right hated Eisenhower for, like much of the rest of his party, making some sort of necessitous peace with the New Deal. But starting in the 1960s, that right gained power within the party. They got it to nominate Barry Goldwater in 1964, but Goldwater was crushed. Richard Nixon, now remembered as a crook and a ghoul, won in 1968 and governed as something of a moderate despite his earlier rabid anti-communism. In fact, Gary Wills called him the last liberal. Nixon normalized relations with China and gave us the EPA and OSHA and even toyed with the idea of a guaranteed minimum income. But in 1980, Ronald Reagan won the presidency, signifying the right's growing domination of the GOP. There were still moderate and even liberal Republicans, but they have, over the last four decades, largely disappeared. The Republican Party is now deeply and uniformly right-wing, one of the most reactionary major parties in the world. Though some cracks are showing, the party is totally dominated by the lunatic Trump, who has an army of loyal servants who will do anything for him. How did this happen? That's a question that Paul Heidemann answers in his new book, Rogue Elephant, How the Republicans Went from the Party of Business to the Party of Chaos, just out from Verso. Paul is a historian and sociologist who teaches history in New York City. Paul Heidemann. The founders didn't want parties at all. Why not?
The founders were inheritors of the political thought of 18th century England, which was really scarred by the English Civil War in the 1640s. The consensus had been, you can't have factions in politics, you can't have organized factions. That gets out of control, that's the road to civil war. And that combined with the general skepticism of democracy in elite thought at the time that said, you know, the problem with democracy is that they give rise to these factions, particularly the most destructive faction of all, as Madison says in Federalist Number 10, the faction of the poor who organize against the rich, and you need to prevent that. Federalist Number 10, the most famous Federalist paper, is partially about, don't worry, this constitution that we're designing is going to prevent the ills of faction in democracy that people traditionally associate with democracy. So the founders were really worried about parties and thought that the way that they designed the Constitution would prevent the emergence of parties. Of course, as soon as you have something resembling universal suffrage, you're going to get political parties. And Madison himself, who'd been, you know, one of the greatest skeptics of parties, takes a leading role in organizing the Democratic Republicans as the opposition to the Federalists under Washington and Adams.
Soon after the founders said those things, Americans started organizing political parties and they became pioneers of the modern party system in the world. But we have some of the strangest parties in the world. Talk first about the origins of this party system, but then their structural and ideological oddity on the world stage.
Some of the classic political science on parties by people like Maurice Duverger and Samuel Huntington talks about parties. The phrase Duverger uses is parties are a contagion of the left. They're organized by the left. And as the left organizes a political party, the right is kind of forced to respond. And they use this model to talk about the spread of political parties throughout Europe in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The United States is a little bit different because workers weren't excluded from the suffrage here the way they were in much of Europe. And so workers are incorporated into the parties from fairly early, and so the parties are these large cross-class affairs. You know, in much of Europe, parties are kind of organized on a class basis from early on in party history. So that's one thing that makes parties kind of strange in the United States is the early universal male suffrage in the United States creates cross-class parties from the beginning. Perhaps a consequence of that is that parties in the United States are not kind of organized particularly around points of principle, but rather coalitions of local notables, right? Elites in different areas put the party together and ally with elites in other areas, and this forms the party. And so the Democratic Party, which is really the first modern political party in the world in the sense that we think of political parties today, the Democratic Party is organized by an alliance between Martin Van Buren and his Albany machine in upstate New York, and Andrew Jackson, and particularly then a group in Richmond, Virginia called the Richmond Junto. And the alliance of these groups was not based on any particular point of principle. In fact, Van Buren said part of the point of organizing this is we're organizing a trans-regional party that will keep slavery out of politics. Slavery will not be a point of dispute in American politics. And so you get this party that's an alliance of these kind of local elites in different parts of the country that aren't united by any particular point of principle, but simply, you know, are find it convenient to act together during presidential elections.
There's that classic Will Rogers joke, which is, you know, quoted way too often, but I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. His heritage goes way back, right?
Yeah, it's deep. It's deep.
Yeah, I keep returning to this quote, though, from a letter from Engels in 1892. The divergence of interests in the same class group is so great in that tremendous area that wholly different groups and interests are represented in each of the two big parties. And almost each particular section of the possessing class has its representatives in each of the two parties. The apparent haphazardness of this jumbling together is what provides the splendid soil for the corruption and the plundering of the government that flourished there so beautifully. 1892 is saying this, and you could almost write this today. The nature of the party system, as you say, goes deep.
Engels isn't the only kind of late 19th century observer to see this. At the same time, Max Weber, you know, a few years later, Max Weber is writing, and he says in the United States that the parties, there's no dispute over interpreting the Constitution, over big questions of politics. There's just rival groups chasing patronage and favors from the government. That's the basis for political divisions, not any sort of like great class questions or anything like that.
What did the New Deal do to the party system in the U.S. when a lot of this stuff got going?
So the New Deal begins a transformation of the party system into something that is much more recognizable today. So before the New Deal, there is no liberal or conservative party in American politics. There are two parties with liberal and conservative wings. There were liberal Republicans who, you know, often called themselves progressives in the Midwest and were reformers, like La Follette in Wisconsin. And there are liberal Democrats. Woodrow Wilson claimed the progressive mantle. And then there are conservative Republicans who are extremely pro-finance, you know, people like Coolidge, for example. And there are conservative Democrats, and the really conservative Democrats tended to be the agrarian class of the South. So both parties have liberal and conservative wings. What the New Deal does is it consolidates really northern liberals into the Democratic Party. The most liberal elements in the country become part of the Democratic Party as a result of FDR and the New Deal, and you know, particularly right like the labor movement and forces like that, as well as pro-civil rights forces in the North, they become firmly attached to the Democratic Party. But this process is quite incomplete, because at the same time that, you know, the most liberal voters in the North have really been consolidated into the party, the most conservative people in the entire country, who are the southern agrarian elite, are also still part of the Democratic Party. And so the New Deal starts this process of sorting that goes really from the 30s to the 1960s, in which the Democrats are becoming the consistently liberal party and the Republicans are becoming the consistently conservative party. But it takes decades to shake out, and ultimately it's the civil rights movement that really completes that transformation and drives the southern conservatives out of the Democratic Party and into the Republican Party. So the New Deal, by establishing a social democratic pole in American politics, starts the process of sorting the American parties that we take for granted today, that, right, the liberals are in the Democratic Party and the conservatives are in the Republican Party.
Democrats, liberal Democrats in the 1950s and early 1960s, the Democrats were divided between programmatic liberals who wanted to make this something of a social democratic party versus the party hacks who didn't want anything of the sort. What was the fight like in those decades?
People like Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn, right, these really important party leaders.
That quote from Johnson is amazing. The biggest danger to American stability is the politics of principle, which brings out the masses in irrational fights for unlimited goals. And once the masses begin to move, the whole thing begins to explode. So
yeah,
They wanted to prevent that, right?
Yes. Yes. So Johnson wants to keep the old Jim Crow ruling class in the Democratic Party, because he says, look, if we've had the solid South for decades now, if we lose that, we lose a lot of political power. It's going to become a lot harder for us to win elections. And he was also, as that quote suggests, ideologically opposed to, like, the emergence of a true social democratic party in American politics, which is what the liberals in the Democratic Party are groping towards. Not all of them think about things in that way, but that's what they're kind of moving towards. And so the party leadership in Congress really worked to frustrate that and is trying to, you know, block a lot of the civil rights initiatives that the party liberals are pushing in the 1950s in particular. Don't want the party to be seen as simply the party of labor. They're trying to hold the center, trying to keep this coalition together, while the Democratic Party liberals are basically like, we are actively trying to kick the Jim Crow ruling class out of the party.
The liberals eventually won this, but then they crashed on Vietnam, right?
Yeah. So this coalition that had been pushing all through the 50s and early 60s, that had included Americans for Democratic Action, these various kind of liberal groups, and the labor movement in a really important way, they're all pushing to get this consistently liberal party. And then it appears in some ways that Johnson is going to be the culmination of this, somewhat ironically, because his role in the Senate, as you said, is the opposite. But the war in Vietnam splits this coalition horribly. And a lot of these liberals who had been like, we want a programmatically liberal party, they actually, like Americans for Democratic Action, by 68, is abandoning Johnson, which would, you know, just would have been unthinkable even 5 years earlier. And so some of the liberals follow their principles and say, we can't support someone who's prosecuting this absolutely criminal war. Whereas the bulk of the labor movement says, Johnson is our man, we will never leave him and stand by him. And this reform coalition fractures. Right. At the moment, it looked like it should have been poised to take over the party. They've succeeded in giving the Jim Crow ruling class the boot. All of a sudden, things fall apart for them. And it's precisely over Vietnam.
But also, there's a bit of a culture war, as we'd call it today, right? Too many hippies, the labor movement didn't like that. They didn't like that about the anti-war movement. They probably liked the war contracts, too. So this culture war really is also a point of contention.
Yeah, a lot of the attacks against McGovern in 72 that the Republicans used, most of them really originate with the labor movement attacking their rivals in the Democratic Party. What was it? Acid, amnesty, and abortion is what McGovern stands for. That was like a Democratic union leader that coined that term. That wasn't a Republican. The Republicans, of course, were only too happy to pick it up. So yeah, there really was this fight, and you know, these groups, the blue collar construction unions, some of the most conservative unions, the building trades, right? They really kind of saw themselves as the authentic voice of the working class, even as, of course, in the late 60s and early 70s, there's actually, you know, the working class is itself going under a cultural transformation. There's a lot of long hairs in the factories, and they start leading wildcat strikes in various industries in these years. So there's an attempt by certain unions to position themselves as the voice of the working class, whereas the real situation was much more complex than that.
Getting back to Johnson for a moment, though, you know, when he signed the Civil Rights Bill, he says, there goes the South, right? So he had warned about that 10 years earlier, but then he essentially accomplished it.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think, in a sense, you have to give Johnson credit for the Civil Rights Act. He went all out packing pork into those bills in order to make sure that they passed, ensuring that he could get enough Southern defectors on those to pass them. So Johnson does deserve some credit for that. And also, you know, the people around Johnson pushing this had a bigger theory than just, well, there goes the South. People like Martin Luther King, right? Their theory was, look, when you give black Americans in the South the vote, that's going to transform Southern politics, and actually it's going to make the Democrats more competitive in the South because they're going to have this new base to lean on. And really, for 20, 25 years or so after the Civil Rights Act, they were right about that. The South was largely competitive. Democrats were winning at a lot of different levels in the South in all of these years. Gavin Wright has a paper showing that it's the passage of NAFTA that completely killed the Democratic Party in the South and ends this kind of biracial coalition that existed from the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 65 up until the early 90s.
I'm speaking with Paul Heidemann, author of Rogue Elephant, just out from Verso. Now we'll get to the stars of the show, the Republicans, in a moment, but one more question about the Democrats. There was the New Politics movement of the 70s. What was that about? What did it accomplish, and what were the effects of it?
So that was basically the elements of the Reform Coalition of the 50s and 60s who held true to their liberal principles and said, what Johnson's doing in Vietnam is criminal. We can't support it. We need to organize an alternative. And they were joined by a massive infusion of people coming, you know, who had come of age in the mid to late 60s for whom the Vietnam War was, you know, the animating issue of their political lives. And this movement kind of swept into the party. And in 1968, the movement to dump Johnson is kind of at the center of this fight in the Democratic Party, right? The effort to stop a sitting president from running from re-election. And they're successful. Johnson decides not to run. And when it comes to the convention, Hubert Humphrey, who was Johnson's vice president, is able to kind of sew up the nomination, even though he hadn't run in a single primary, because primaries only allocated a very small number of convention delegates at this time. Most convention delegates were simply, elected officials, party officials, people like that. And so Humphrey's able to sew up the nomination, even though he didn't run in a single primary. At the same time, the New Politics people are fighting for changes in the rules, right? And changing for the creation of a commission that would alter the Democratic Party's rules, partially because they thought that the way Humphrey won was so undemocratic. And the Humphrey-Johnson forces at the convention give them this in order to placate them, because they're like, look, we got the nomination this year. If they want to have a little commission for the next 4 years, fine. This turns out to be a big mistake on their part, because this commission, which becomes the McGovern-Fraser Commission, starts enacting some really far-reaching changes in Democratic Party rules, like creating a much bigger role for primaries and allocating convention delegates. And they also start suggesting things like the Democratic Party should have an off-year political convention which decides on the party's platform apart from the nominee, right? This is one of those kind of weird things about American politics is parties don't have platforms, they have nominees, and the nominees get to build really whatever platform they basically want. There was this attempt in the McGovern-Fraser Commission coming out of New Politics to turn the Democrats into something more like the British Labour Party, right, which has a platform apart from whoever the leader of the party is at a given moment. And this initiative was resisted by the kind of old powers of the Democratic Party, including some of the more conservative elements of the union movement, fiercely over the next few years. And essentially what happened was they made half of a revolution, right? They won an increased place for primaries so that primaries would now be the main way in which delegates were allocated, but they failed at creating a more disciplined, unified party. And in fact, creating a bigger role for parties without that in some ways created a more candidate-centered party, not a less candidate-centered one.
The Republicans picked up on the primaries too, right?
Yeah, the Republicans followed suit. And I mean, part of this was because in Democratic-controlled states, laws were passed saying you have to run primaries. And so Republicans in those states had to. And I think they also, you know, they felt that, like, not following suit on this would give them a disadvantage that would allow the Democrats to claim that they were a more Democratic party, small d.
Okay, now on to our friends in the Grand Old Party. Now, the Republicans were so crushed in the 1930s by the Roosevelt domination. The New Deal was immensely popular. And the bulk of the Republican Party, even a bunch of the business community, had made reluctant peace with the New Deal. They didn't necessarily like it, but they realized it was here to stay, or so they thought. Some conservatives objected, but what was the Republican Party of the 50s like?
By the 1950s, those Republicans who counseled compromise with the New Deal had been in control of the National Party by and large since roughly 1940, right? In 1940, Wendell Willkie is nominated, who's a businessman, but a very liberal one, and in fact is so liberal that he and Roosevelt, after the election, talked about forming a new party together. And then subsequent Republican presidential nominees followed in roughly this same mold. They really came from the more moderate wing of the party. And it's finally one of these people from this wing of the party, Dwight Eisenhower, who takes the White House back for the Republicans and starts governing. But in some ways, this turns out to be a poisoned chalice for the Republican moderates, because Eisenhower's governance as a moderate is really what sets in motion the right wing of the party that starts developing in those years and really bursts onto the national political scene with the Goldwater candidacy in 64. This is National Review is founded in these years, and you know the founders of National Review said explicitly, like, Eisenhower's philosophy of modern republicanism was what really exercised us and got us in motion. So when Republicans finally got a chance to govern and did so in a way that compromised with the New Deal, that's what spurred the right wing of the party into furious action, and that started really kind of moving to take control of the party.
Yeah, it's one of the things that strikes me over and over again is how the right in the 1950s and 60s, even in the 70s, had no reluctance to challenge the party at all, even doing it damage, running as spoilers often. When Bill Buckley ran for mayor in New York City in 1965, he ran precisely to destroy liberal republicanism, he said. It seems like a lot of leftish Democrats are a little reluctant to be so destructive and to be painted as spoilers. Do you have any thoughts on why that would be?
The right is definitely fiercer on that front. I mean, in 1960, the attempt to push Goldwater as the nominee against Nixon, which ultimately fails, but that attempt in itself was a pretty radical action that there's not really an analog for among the Democrats until the Dump Johnson moment, which comes at a period of much greater crisis for the party, right? Like, 1960 was not a period of crisis for the Republican Party. They're coming out of holding the White House for 8 years. So, yeah, that really tells you something about the combativeness of the right. And, of course, even when, you know, Nixon is elected, who today we tend to see as kind of the candidate of right-wing backlash, the party right was very unhappy with Nixon, who, of course, was never looking out for anyone besides Richard Nixon and was happy to make any number of compromises if they would enhance his own power and you know, in many ways, governed in a way that was much more liberal than any subsequent Republicans, creating all these new regulatory offices, embracing various Keynesian measures. So the party right really hated Nixon, particularly in his first term when he's doing all of this stuff. They fall in love with him again during Watergate, of course.
My first presidential vote was cast against Nixon because he wasn't conservative enough. That was back in my Party of the Right days. But after they managed to get Goldwater nominated, which is an amazing thing. I mean, it's, you know, it kind of came out of nowhere if you weren't really following this stuff very closely. He was pretty marginal, not that popular. And who was it? Murray Kempton said the Peasants' Rebellion or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you know, as Rick Perlstein showed, the nomination of Goldwater is really accomplished through backroom skullduggery in terms of these various mini coups in state Republican parties, as the portion of the party that wanted to nominate Goldwater was willing to do anything to make that happen, including, sabotaging various polls and various delegate allocation procedures. I mean, there was really unhinged factional warfare going on, but really from one side only, right? Rockefeller's people weren't doing anything comparable.
So after Goldwater's loss, which was massive, the Republican Party restructured itself. The party chair, Ray Bliss, whose slogan was "Keep issues out of campaigns," which is a remarkable thing to say, Bliss turned it into an ideologically neutral service organization, which sounds neutral, but it actually helped the right over the longer term. How did that work out?
Yeah, so Bliss came out of Ohio politics, where he had developed a reputation as an extremely competent campaign tactician. And, you know, Ohio politics in the Republican Party at this time is ruled by Robert Taft, who was the kind of grand old man of the right wing of the Republican Party in Congress. But Bliss never had Taft's ideological commitments. Instead, he was all about, look, the job of the party is to provide services for the nominee to help them win. And issues only get in the way of that. The party should have basically no opinion on issues whatsoever. After Goldwater's loss, Goldwater puts his own guy in the RNC in 64, and afterwards he gets the boot, and Bliss is kind of brought in as someone everybody can live with. And a lot of the moderates in the party think, like, okay, this is great because this guy's not a crazy Goldwaterite. At least we don't have a Goldwaterite in charge of the RNC. But the problem is, since Bliss was so non-ideological and was building the party in such a way that it would support whoever won the nomination, no matter what their politics, he offered no resistance to these zealots, right, who had just rigged their own primary for Goldwater as they moved to consolidate power in the party. And so this kind of ideologically neutral figure defanged the RNC. And the RNC had really, since the 1940s, been a bulwark against the party right. They're like, we're never going to win a presidential election with one of these right-wingers. We need a moderate like Eisenhower or Nixon to win.
And the Democrats ended up imitating this service model, right?
Yeah, they saw that, that it provided a really useful model, and they started saying, yes, the job of the DNC should just be to support whichever party wins, right? And I think particularly to the forces in the Democratic Party who were resisting new politics, this model of a non-ideological national committee was something really attractive to them that they could use as a weapon to stop the formation of the DNC into an organization, again, like the Labor Party that has an ideology apart from a candidate.
And this opened up space for outside money and PACs and all that stuff to really begin infecting the political process.
Yeah. The 70s is a period when campaign costs are just rising astronomically because it's the period when campaigns really discover television advertising as an indispensable aspect of campaigning. So campaign costs are going through the roof. At the same time, you have modern campaign finance law being constructed in the 70s, partially in reaction to Watergate. An aspect of Nixon's corruption was collecting money in all kinds of illegitimate ways. So there's this push to restructure campaign finance, and the legal infrastructure that arises is one that reinforces the candidate-centered nature of American politics, and hence it's the non-ideological character of the parties, because candidates are required to set up campaign committees that are separate from the party. So the money doesn't go from party to candidate, it goes from donor to campaign committee, and if the campaign committee has enough money, they don't necessarily have to listen to anything the party says, and because the candidate selection happens through a primary, even if the party is totally opposed to this person, they can still win, which is basically what happens with Donald Trump. So this rise in campaign costs and the legal infrastructure that's created around it also weakens the parties, and the need, the dependence on all of this outside money creates a kind of alternative institutional power to the party, and that's the donors, right? So now it's not enough to have the power of the party behind you. You need the donors as well. And, you can kind of think of it that, like, earlier in the first half of the 20th century, what parties provided that was so important was people power, volunteers and party workers who would go out there and do all of the kind of face-to-face work of campaigning. But as television replaces that, labor stops to be the key input in the campaign production function, and money becomes the key input instead. So now the place of the party is much less important, and the place of the donor becomes much more elevated.
That was the first part of my interview with Paul Heidemann, author of Rogue Elephant, just out from Verso. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the Stimulus of Loss for flutes and Aune Martineau by Suzanne Farron, performed by Claire Chase on the flutes and the composer on the Aune Martineau. Aune Martineau, French for Martineau waves, is an early electronic instrument invented by Maurice Martineau almost 100 years ago. You can find this track and a lot of Chase's other marvelous work on Bandcamp. And now the second part of my interview with Paul Heidemann, author of Rogue Elephant, just out from Verso. Skipping over the Reagan years and landing in the 90s, the parties were changing in important ways. One, in the Democratic Party, Clinton was remaking it in the interests of the Democratic Leadership Council, courting business, ran it ending welfare as we know it, all of the famous moves right that, for example, Lily Geisman wrote about. And there was a substantial Goldman Sachs wing of the Democratic Party, personified by Robert Rubin. So what was the Democratic Party looking like in the 90s?
Yeah, Clinton is remaking the party, and, from the 80s onwards, there had been this wing of the Democratic Party that was saying, in order to compete with the Republicans, we have to go right on cultural issues. This was one of the big obsessions of the DLC, right, is be tough on crime, be tough on welfare mothers, all of this kind of stuff. And if we want to raise enough money, we have to really court business. And in the 80s, you know, you had seen some glimpses of this in the Democratic Party with Tony Coelho, who ultimately got in a lot of trouble for his fundraising from business. So the Democrats are courting business more and more aggressively. And, you know, the first Clinton term is kind of an interesting interregnum in this process because Clinton ends up turning left on health care and proposing something much more ambitious than Obamacare, actually. But it gets shot down by business opposition. And then in Clinton's second term, it's all service to business all of the time. So the Democrats are, in trying to kind of compete with the Republicans in the success of Reaganism, are more focused than ever on raising money from business and on remaking themselves to be more moderate and right wing.
And then the other side of the aisle, the Gingrich Revolution. What was that all about?
So Gingrich understood better than anyone else in American politics the new role of money in campaigns and sees that this is going to be absolutely key. And the way that Gingrich acts on this is pretty interesting. He ends up taking over a PAC called GOPAC that had been founded by one of the DuPonts in Delaware, actually. And the thing about GOPAC is that it was a state-level PAC. It wasn't a federal PAC. And because of that, it could not donate money to candidates for federal office. But what Gingrich used it to do instead was to boost himself and his leadership and to create networks of donors and put donors in touch with candidates across the country through holding like events and speeches and things like that. And so he starts to raise all of this money through GOPAC that is not regulated by federal campaign finance law because it's not donating to federal candidates, but he's using it to create a network to donate direct huge amounts of money all over the country to different Republicans that is creating all of this dependence among this new class of Republicans who are getting elected in the late 80s and early 90s on Gingrich and his network. Suddenly, everyone has Newt to thank for their win. There's all these quotes of people being like, we were just getting hammered, and then Newt called, and suddenly all of these donors from all over the country that I'd never met are dumping money into my campaign. And so Gingrich creates this, and by 92, 94, some political scientists are referring to it as a shadow National Republican Congressional Committee, right? It's raising money on that scale. It's just a huge organization. And at the same time that Gingrich is doing this, he's telling all of the Republicans in Congress, you need to be dialing for dollars all day, every day. And that practice that we take for granted now as a part of politics was not standard at all then. Gingrich is the one who brings that in, and it's like, you should every day need to be spending hours calling people and asking them for money. So Gingrich, his ascent to leadership in Congress is paved by this redistribution of money throughout the party. And the Democrats come to imitate him in that regard. And so now the path to leadership in both parties is creating a leadership pack where you fundraise and then you dole out the goods to the rest of the party. And the people who do that most successfully are the people who rise the fastest. Nancy Pelosi was a real master at this, which is what explains her longevity in the Democratic Party.
Along with Newt and this new style of money raising came the bomb throwing style. Republicans in Congress became, you want to get in the headlines or get focused upon by the C-SPAN cameras by causing a lot of trouble. So it really changed the culture of the Republican Party as well.
Yeah, Newt had kind of pioneered this stuff in the 80s with his battles against the Democratic leadership in Congress. This is bomb-throwing style and always accusing the other side of ethical misdeeds and things like that, which is, of course, ironic coming from Newt. And the people who kind of come up alongside Newt in this period prove in some ways to be better at it than him, most notably Tom DeLay, who started out as an exterminator in Texas and then ran for Congress when the EPA outlawed his favorite pesticide and came into Congress and was known for two things. For one, ferocious partisan bulldog and going after the Democrats with everything he had. And two, for being maybe even better than Newt at redistributing money across the party. I mean, there's a famous story about him having checks from the tobacco industry and literally just handing out the checks to people on the floor of Congress in what was a pretty brazen display of corruption. This generation of people that's coming up, they practice a style of partisan warfare, which was pretty unknown to Republicans in Congress before this. You know, by the 1980s, Republicans have been the minority in Congress for 30-odd years straight, and they're used to the fact that to get things done, you kind of cooperate with the Democrats. Gingrich, DeLay, and their generation come in and totally upend that.
By the end of the 90s, as the new millennium dawned, the Republicans were in disarray. They were fighting with each other. They just had the impeachment disaster. Clinton went out with a pretty high approval rating. He'd made a lot of friends in the tech world, creating a lot of whole new constituency for the Democratic Party. Into that comes George W. Bush, who many of us remember as a somewhat dim and incompetent fool, but he was anything but, really.
Yeah. So at the end of the 90s, you know, these new bomb throwers in the Republican Party had kind of had their chance with impeachment, and they'd blown it, right? Impeachment had totally backfired on them. A number of their side had to resign for, you know, extramarital affairs when people started looking at them, in addition to Clinton. So the old kind of party establishment of the George H.W. Bush wing of the party looked at this as kind of their chance. George W. Bush, of course, is a perfect person for this, as H.W.'s son, and who had really governed Texas as a moderate. He'd been a really big education guy. He had not engaged in any of the kind of race baiting of Latinos that had become a prominent part of Republican politics in a lot of places in the 90s. He had actually, I think, won a majority of Latino voters in Texas in his reelection campaign. So a lot of the establishment wing of the party, C.W., as the alternative to Gingrich and DeLay. But the thing about George W. is that, unlike his father, he had become a born-again Christian and was fluent in the vernacular of the religious right and could speak to their concerns in a very genuine way. Right? George H.W. Bush, of course, was known as Rubbers for his enthusiasm for birth control. George W. Bush had no such deviations like that. So what George W. Bush is able to do is to bring these two wings of the party together that by the end of the 90s had really been at each other's throats. And both of them are able to find something they like in Bush, and his presidency is able to bring these together. Now, you know, 9/11 really helps with this, and the subsequent imperial adventures were an endeavor that both wings of the party could really get behind. So he's aided in that. But in general, Bush sets about creating a corporate coalition behind the Republican Party that harkens back to the days of Mark Hanna and McKinley. And that work creates, for a time period, a Republican Party that looks like it could be hegemonic in the same way that McKinley's was. And that's certainly how people like Karl Rove like to think of themselves. They thought they were building a Republican hegemony that would last decades.
But it didn't. The Iraq War became very unpopular. Then there was the financial crisis. So Bush went from like a 92% approval rating to like a 20% approval rating by the end of his term. So Obama became president. What happened to the Republican Party after the Bush disaster?
Yeah, if George W. Bush's first term was holding together the wings of the party, his second term was that just completely collapsing, and the emergence of a new intensity of intra-party warfare. So for like the bailout for the financial crisis, most Republicans reject the first bill. George W. Bush personally calls every member of the Texas congressional delegation to ask them to vote for it. A majority of them still say no. And so there is this huge divide in the party between these people who say, okay, we're going to just go all out in kind of opposing everything, and the wing that are still closer to Bush's vision of things. And this division is exacerbated over the course of the 2010s by the emergence of some new players in campaign finance, which is the Koch Network. In the kind of 90s and 2000s, the Koch Network had been kind of around the Libertarian Party for a while, and then had started to dip their toes into Republican Party politics in the 2000s during the Bush presidencies. And in the 2010s, they really emerge as a self-conscious political actor with a very different vision for the party than the one that prevailed during the Bush years. This intensely libertarian project and a level of intensity to their opposition to the Democrats that really put to shame even Bush and Cheney and their gang. And they start raising money on a scale that by about 2014 is rivaling groups like the Chamber of Commerce, who are a bulwark of the Republican establishment, and the RNC itself. The amount of money that they're able to raise from these ideologically kind of committed billionaires is just staggering. And they're able to use that money to power this insurgency in the party, right? That insurgency kind of at the grassroots takes the shape of the Tea Party. And all of this weakens the Republican Party as an institution even further, right? The Tea Party is not officially linked to the Republican Party in any way. It's not right. It's not disciplined by the party. It's not responding to party decision makers. It's its own thing, right? It's this kind of leaderless networked social movement of the kind that we see all throughout the 2010s. And the Koch network also is independent of the party. So you have these actors who are trying to change Republican politics and are not accountable in any way to the party institution. Well, the party establishment wants to fight back against this, and so Karl Rove forms his own super PAC, American Crossroads, to try and fight back. But in founding his own super PAC, he's only disempowering the party farther, because now he's competing, the people who support the kind of party establishment, he wants them to donate to his super PAC, not to the RNC. This warfare among what could be called the shadow parties pushes the Republican Party itself as an institution even further into the background of politics and gives it an even smaller role in determining what's going to happen in politics in the United States.
Leaving a perfect point of entry for Donald Trump.
Yes, this warfare between kind of the Koch network and Karl Rove and the party establishment really reaches a stalemate by about 2014, 2016. Both sides are entrenched. It's really trench warfare, right? It's a war of position, as Gramsci might say. This stalemate creates a situation where Donald Trump is able to step in, offering a politics that neither side of that fight was really embracing. You know, after the Republican autopsy in 2012, following Mitt Romney's defeat, the party establishment said, look, we need to get away from these anti-immigrant politics, right? We need to kick that to the curb, and we need to make a renewed argument for fiscal conservatism and that kind of thing. Trump comes in, and he's saying, we're going to double down on the nastiest, most xenophobic anti-immigrant politics. And instead of embracing fiscal conservatism, we're going to say no cuts to Social Security and no cuts to Medicare. So Trump comes in, and this combination just kind of didn't exist in Republican politics. And neither side of the battle in the party understood the opening that had been created, right? The way that the party base had kind of drifted from either of their sides. Trump saw that and seized it, and the fact that there's this warfare in the party means that it's very hard for both sides that oppose Trump to coordinate to effectively oppose him. And that's what happens basically in the 2016 primaries is Jeb Bush, who represents the establishment, says, oh, this is great. Trump is dividing the real crazies between himself and Ted Cruz. This is going to make things easier for me. I'm not going to attack him. I'm just going to say good things about him. Ted Cruz says, Trump is riling up all of the crazies, and that's going to be great for me because I'm going to be able to harvest them. That's going to really make Jeb Bush look weak and bad in this race. So I'm not going to attack Trump either. Trump is actually just renting my voters, is what he says. But, of course, with Trump, possession is nine-tenths of the law.
I'm speaking with Paul Heidemann, author of Rogue Elephant, just out from Verso. During these decades, there was a growth of a protectionist wing in the Republican Party, a nationalist, nativist, protectionist wing in the Republican Party. The other day, I saw a video of Trump from 1999 denouncing Pat Buchanan, one of the people who brought that wing in, as a Hitler-loving wacko. times do change. But yeah, there was also this change in the base of the party. But one of the standard explanations that you hear for the rise of Trump is a change in the nature of the Republican electorate. More working class, for one. Is that true?
The party had been acquiring more of a working class base for some time. You know, back during the Bush administration, Ross Douthat and Rehan Salam write a piece called Sam's Club Republicanism. That's all about how the party is kind of going to be the party of these, like, working class suburbanites, basically. And that's who they should reorient to. So there have been discussions about that ongoing. And Trump certainly benefits from that process. The part of the conventional wisdom that's wrong, I think, is that Trump creates this giant swing in the working class towards the Republicans. You don't really see that happening. What Trump is able to effectively do, though, is with his kind of very forthright protectionism and the way he talks about the damage that international trade has caused various working class communities, is he's able to speak to people, particularly in some key states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. There's been some analysis showing that in counties in these states where there had been factory closures, there's a big swing to Trump among white working class voters. So Trump doesn't turn the party into a working class class party, but his focus on trade in particular does allow him to squeak out that very narrow victory in these key states, even if, you know, he loses the popular vote in 2016.
I imagine you finished writing most of this book before you could see much of Trump, too. You say at one point about Trump 1, the American state, trisected by Madisonian design, is deeply ill-suited to personalist rule. Passing legislation requires negotiation with congressional parties. Executive orders are subject to judicial review. He combines successful personalist rule over a party with a failed attempt to exert personalist rule over a state. Would you change any of that now?
He's definitely been more successful this time in exerting personalist rule over the state. And, you know, the fact that he has brought in this cadre of functionaries who are totally committed to him and his vision, right? The prominence of people like Stephen Miller, Attorney General like Bondi, who I think has zero limits in what she would be willing to do to advance Trump's power, has certainly allowed him to act with greater control of the state this time. But I do think that the same kind of fundamental barriers are there. Trump has passed one big piece of legislation, basically, right? The one big beautiful bill. Similarly, this time around in 2017, in his first term, he passed one piece of legislation, really a big tax cut. So you're still seeing this kind of failure to legislate. And the fact that they're trying to do everything through executive order and executive action has meant that things are getting totally gummed up in the courts in all kinds of ways. I mean, the Supreme Court is almost certainly going to strike down most, if not all, of Trump's emergency tariffs in the coming weeks. He is still attempting to rule as a personalist, and that is still creating large frictions for him, even if he's much more terrifyingly successful than last time in the authoritarianism around deportations and things like that. I would also add that this time around, the biological factor has come into play, in that Trump is clearly slowing down, not as capable of roiling a crowd and keeping a crowd with him as he was 8 years ago. In a personalist regime, this is even more damaging than it was to someone like Joe Biden, and it was pretty damaging to Joe Biden. You know, I just saw last week that the Republican Party is thinking about sending Trump on a speaking tour to talk about the cost of living and inflation around the country, which I would personally love to see, although if I were a Republican, I certainly wouldn't be recommending that.
Yes.
So I do think that this Trump's own kind of declining capacities are going to hit in an even harder way this term, precisely again because he tries to rule in such a personalist manner. So as his personal abilities fade, his power will as well. And in some ways, to be honest, in the last couple weeks, it feels like we've been seeing the start of that process already.
Yeah, I want to return to that in a second, but one has been surprised by the lack of elite opposition to some of his policies. Tariffs, for example, you know, this just violates every sacred principle of Wall Street and big business. Yet, I've read some accounts that business people don't like it, but they're afraid to cross Trump, so they're not speaking up. I don't know if that's true or not.
That's true.
But what do you make of that lack of elite opposition to this very destructive rule?
The American ruling class, since the 1980s, has defeated its historic enemy in the labor movement. And as a result, their ability to act cohesively and collectively has really decayed since then. And instead, the modes of action that you see from capitalists are much more self-dealing, sectional, short-term, things like that. One of the issues that the Business Roundtable got most upset about in the 1990s was a, like, CEO pay law, right? And we're not talking about, like, the long-term direction of American capitalism with this kind of stuff. We're talking about, like, the narrowest prerogatives of corporate management.
That battle between shareholders and managers, so that was a big deal. It was like an intra-class civil war.
Yeah. The managers, in some ways, have been losing that fight in a lot of ways.
They became the shareholders, so in a community of interest. You started mentioning, you're talking about this a moment ago, but let's go back to it and conclude on this note. Until a few weeks ago, Trump seemed almighty, but there are a lot of cracks showing. We have to be careful since doom has been pronounced many times before. But where do you think this is all going? You wrote about Marjorie Taylor Greene at the end of the book as a colorful money raiser, but now she's exposing and amplifying fissures within the party over Israel, globalism, the Epstein stuff. Trump isn't immortal, or so I hope, but where are we now and where is this likely to go?
Yeah, I think we're likely to see a return to the kind of factional warfare that characterized the party for, you know, much of the Obama administration. Without Trump's force in holding the different factions of the party and subsuming them both under himself, I think we're likely to see more and more of the kind of battles that characterized the party in those periods. And people like Green, who have built this base for themselves, you know, she's one of the biggest fundraisers in the party because she's really good at getting on TV. And she's, you know, a kind of splendid undisciplined political operator.
That's one way to put it, yes.
my read is kind of that, like, she believed Trump when during the campaign he said, we're going to release these Epstein files, and she feels like he kind of made a fool of her when he did a 180 on that, and she's upset about it. And because she has this base of money, you know, she can go off and take on Trump in this way. And, you know, I think she's a much harder target for Trump than someone like Thomas Massey, you know, who's been much, much less prominent. As Trump continues to kind of fade, it's just hard to see that not happening on a personal level, the battle to succeed him will see the knives come out in the party in a way that we haven't seen. There was a brief time in kind of 2023, 2024, leading up to the primary when DeSantis was running, but, you know, at the end of the day, DeSantis was afraid to take the knives out for Trump, right? And that's the reason he lost. I think what's going to look like as kind of Trump becomes less and less able to hold the party together is much, much fiercer partisan warfare. And I think it's really going to test the abilities of someone like Mike Johnson, who up to now has been very successful in keeping an incredibly fractious party in Congress together. I think we're going to see much more defections from that. Turbulence ahead is really unavoidable for the party.
And where do you see the money bags going in all this?
Yeah, I think that's a complicated question. I mean, you've got this, like, new section of the tech right that is very committed to Trump. And I think efforts to kind of woo those donors will be at the center of this new competition in the party, right? Like, it's going to be a competition for who can promise the most to Peter Thiel and Elon Musk and these kind of folks. Whether that kind of race has any appeal to the rest of the American ruling class remains to be seen, right? If everyone's just kind of promising bigger and bigger things to tech in order to win that money, the kind of bulk of corporate money that stayed with the Democrats these past three elections could very well stay there again. Although, of course, in two of those three elections, that wasn't enough to win for the party.
Of course, if the AI bubble bursts, then who knows where it's all going to go.
We could see tech guys go from kind of the crown princes of the right to scapegoats very, very quickly.
That was Paul Heidemann, author of Rogue Elephant, just out from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Since we were short on Reagan material, let's compensate by going out with a bit of Ronald Reagan by the Swedish punk band Charter 77. Till next week, bye.
Ronald Reagan, it's a monkey, Ronald Reagan, it's a donkey, Ronald Reagan, it's a tanker, Ronald Reagan.